I've got one thing. Well, I've talked about it a lot before. I often use the word to wobble, the verb to wobble, or the present participle wobbling. And a woman who comes to Roman's sittings in Prague asked him to ask me why I use the word wobbling. She's a sports psychologist. And she couldn't understand why I used the word wobbling. So, I thought about it. And I suppose, for me, balance primarily is physical. Maybe not be for you, but primarily for me, balance is physical. I always think of riding a bike or standing on one leg or walking on a tightrope. In order to do all those activities, to keep balance, you go from side to you wobble. Even an expert tightrope walker wobbles. Mm-hmm. The pole isn't so he can keep perfect balance, but so he can wobble with a bit of inertia to keep him where he is. But in the psychological sense, it's a bit different. Nishijima Roshi used to draw a diagram on the blackboard. We had a blackboard in the temple, and he would bring it out and draw things on it. Usually he'd write down the four philosophies and go through them for the 999th time. Sometimes he'd draw a diagram, like a graph, vertical axis, horizontal axis, and then he'd do like this. He'd say, our lives go up and down, up and down. This is the zero line, and we wobble about zero. Happy, sad, excited, heavy, you know. And, of course, that's not really wobbling in a physical sense, but I use the word wobbling to describe that too. The fact that balance, which is one of Dogen's themes, is actually doesn't exist. It's an ideal, it's a concept. Only thing that exists is what I call wobbling. And when we wobble, there's a centre that we wobble about. And that centre, which is imaginary, is what we imagine balance is. But it's also related to our way of thinking. We think in absolutes, would seem, because we have archetypal concepts, which are usually they're perfect. They're archetypes, so they're perfect. So when we think, we can't help thinking of balance is, you know, zero is absolutely nothing. People think in the Buddhist world about awakened or enlightened or whatever, and we automatically we can't help thinking that those are states, and we use the word state. But state doesn't exist either. Even though physicists use the word state, an electron is in, you know, so-and-so state. But states don't actually exist in reality. The only thing that exists in reality is change. But we can't really say anything if everything's always changing, because as soon as we say something, it's changed. I think Wittgenstein wrote in one of his little books, the end of this sentence is in a different time to the beginning. We say time. Time is what moves us through change. Whether time is a concept or not, we could debate. But it seems that change is something that's fundamental. But we can't think in terms of constant change, so we think in terms of states. And then we think that the state we've imagined will stay. Whether it's my life in the Czech Republic, or happiness, or my miserable feeling today, we have some kind of inertia, or makes us think that whatever is happening will go on happening, and I suppose society, we're educated to believe that that's how life is. Yeah, life is constant, isn't it? Things do stay the same, don't they? And because we repeat it to each other and believe it, maybe we don't see that things are changing all the time. I'm going to go back to my place, and it will be there, and my life will return to normal. It's all a kind of projection of constant stability. And to say that none of that exists seems to go against normal understanding of life. But I wonder whether our normal understanding of life is real, or whether we just say it so often we end up believing it. Or something between the two. So all the concepts that we use in Buddhism all sound like they're fixed, and yet none of them are. So to come to a retreat and expect to get some state is unfortunately very unlikely, if not impossible. We might be able to sit with an open, empty mind, but how long is that for? And if it's not for very long, does that mean we're not doing it right, or it will become longer if we do it more? So by the nature of the way we think, and the way we think has influenced the way society presents life to us, as we're educated, we think there is constancy. but there is only change. In Buddhist books and things, they use the word impermanence, which I think is a stupid word. I don't know. It's too abstract for me. The Buddha realized the nature of impermanence. You know, it's too sophisticated for me. You notice everything changes, because it does. And we can see things changing in our own zazen. And that's what zazen is. So in a physical sense, we're wobbling in order to sit in balance. And in a psychological sense, we're wobbling. So whatever it is we're seeking, hard luck, it's not there. It's gone already. But we can experience that, the nature of that change, because our education and our society teaches us that things don't change. In that sense, you know, stability. So to experience all this stuff that's going on in zazen today, for example, is your zazen like that? You know, is it right? Is it okay? Well, maybe it's just the nature of reality. So for me, in the sense that I use the word rather crudely, everything's wobbling. I like to think that atomic physicists have heard what I said and realised that's why all these subatomic particles are all wobbling around their little orbits. Sorry, that's just one thing that came into my head while I was eating my cake.
That's such a common experience as a psychotherapist, to have people coming along, and what they're bringing is they've gone down and they feel they shouldn't have gone down in mood. And it's because they've been educated by society that there is a fixed state which they should be aiming for, which is a slightly elevated, balanced state. And any departure from that, particularly any movement down, is a pathological movement. Mm. So quite a lot of the work is, it's like re-educating people about the sort of nature of psychological processes, in terms of you're supposed to go down. You're supposed to go up and down. It's so basic.
I was thinking about that as well. And also that when they're down, they think that it's going to be forever.
That's right.
Yes. We do, yeah. Don't we? Yeah. I do. Mm.
So to educate them that it's not going to be forever, just to relax. Mm.
If I go down, I'm black, my glasses are black, so that everything I look at is black, and it's going to stay forever.
It's an interesting word I was reminded of recently, which is future proofing. Future proofing.
Explain.
Well, making sure that everything stays the same as far as
the
future as you can. It's called future proofing.
Is it? Is that a term?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Big time.
Good work, isn't it?
Yeah, you future proof your strategy, you future proof your infrastructure, you future proof
really?
Your products.
I never heard of it.
Whatever happens in the future can't screw it up. It's guaranteed.
Always prepared for the future change or whatever.
Oh. So other things might change, but not this. What?
That's an organisational word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Councils and businesses use it.
Do they?
Yes, we have to future-proof our strategy or our product. Yeah, so that
future-proof our product.
We've taken everything into account which could possibly happen in the near and far future, and we've got a plan on how to deal with it.
Oh. I mean, to some extent, it might make sense. But if you think there's going to be more extreme weather, you build things that withstand more extreme weather.
That's useful.
The danger is believing it too much, maybe.
I just found it an interesting word.
You can only ever future-proof something against a future that you can imagine. If something happens that you hadn't thought of,
well, you extrapolate the trends, don't you?
Well, that's where you go wrong.
How can I future-proof my Zazen?
Sure there's a market in that somewhere. Future-proofing Zazen. .inc.
Mike and I were talking about earlier about this, the changes, isn't it, Mike, and the how there's just no way of knowing. Because I was telling him that recently in my daily practice I've been finding myself in those spots that are very still, and of course it feels nice. And then I thought, I'm going to come here, I'm going to have more of that because it's longer, you know, longer sessions. And my mind's throwing everything at me. So, you know, since the moment I started, it's like, my hopes were unfounded. And we were discussing that, Mike, and how it's just you can't future-proof our practice.
You're hoping to get something and you can't get it. In that way, being here, sitting in the present is a very weird thing. To get what you want, you have to stop wanting it. To get where you are, you have to stop wanting to be anywhere else. So, how to stop, really? But most of the time, we don't even know that we're doing something to stop it. I think a lot of the time in Zazen, we can notice that our mind and body are churning around. Whether it's our stomach that's churning, or our thoughts that are churning, or whatever. So you could say that's part of it. But it is very difficult to stop. I mean, even in a very simple sense, to stop global warming, we've got to stop doing lots of things. Well, it's very difficult to stop. It's very difficult to stop looking at your phone. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to stop thinking about, oh, I wonder if I've got any emails. Mm-hmm. All these things are very, very difficult to stop. So in that sense, it would seem that the what people like Dogen are suggesting is unachievable, really, in modern society. How can we possibly stop all our madness? Because I feel that the madness is getting faster, quite rapidly. Do you think it will reach a crisis point and then we'll all stop?
I think it's reaching a psychological crisis point at the moment. I don't think people can bear all the stimulation they're getting.
I have a favourite author, Robert Harris. He's an ex-BBC journalist, but he's written lots of books, and for me, they're all fantastic. And he wrote one called The Third Sleep, which I recommend to anybody. The Third Sleep is about life here in society, 1,000 years after something happened that put the whole of society back 200-300 years. So as you read the book, I won't give away the, but as you read the book, you realise that it's 1,000 years hence, but all the infrastructure that we're used to is gone. There are remnants of it, which people look at and wonder what it was for. And people are living in a kind of medieval, right back to, not square one, but it's very, very interesting.
Before I came, there was one thing I wanted to achieve, was to get away from the internet.
Sorry. I brought my iPad and showed you that came from the internet, sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fine. But just not go online or check any emails or anything like that. And I have not checked any emails.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I think I feel good to just get away from the news. And it's just too much. And usually negative as well. And it's, I thought, okay, I'm just going to switch off from there.
Well, that's what a retreat could be about, isn't it?
But we're told, aren't we, that it's good to be aware of everything all the time. It's good to know what's going on globally. Good to take action on all these fronts you're supposed to take action on. That's just a constantly reinforced message. So you go on retreat and you get asked, what do you do that for? And then you get told, oh, well, that was a nice little escape from real life. Now you can get back to real life. I'm sorry, but the other one you get as well is have you got enlightened yet? Oh. I never know how to react. What am I supposed to do?
You should say yes.
You do know.
I tried yes.
You do know how to react.
Try me.
I tried ignoring it.
Nobody's ever asked me that. Nobody's ever said that to me.
Mm-hmm. It's not your wife again.
You're dragging my wife into that.
How dare you?
How dare you, sir? No,
challenge you to
not my wife. No.